Chapter 10. A conflict of jurisdiction. The House of Glore. Stalking secrets. Long after midnight, I was attempting to sleep in my bedchamber at the Dorset Regency. Beckwin and Amos had both retired to their own rooms hours before. Reflected light from the canal outside played a series of silver ripples across the ceiling of my twilit chamber.
Aegis, Rosethorn.
Bettencourt's voxed whisper suddenly tapped at my ear.
Rosethorn, reveal.
Spectres, invasive, spiral vine.
I was already out of bed and into my breeches and boots, pulling my leather coat over my bare torso. I went out into the apartment lounge with my power sword in my hand. The lights were off, but canal reflections played in here too, creating a fluttering half-light. Bettencourt stood by the far wall, a needle pistol in each hand. He nodded at the main door. They were good, and they were very quiet, but we could both see slight movement against the cracks around the doors, backlit by the hall light. A gentle vibration of the handle told me someone was springing the lock. Bettencourt and I dropped back against the walls either side of the doors. We closed our eyes and covered our ears. Any forcing of the door would trigger the deterrent charges, and we didn't want to wind up blind or deaf. The door opened a crack. No flash charges roared. Our visitors had detected and neutralized the security countermeasures. They were even better than I first thought. A slender telescopic rod extended smoothly in through the crack. An optical sensor on the end slowly began to pan around, searching the room. With a nod to Bettencourt, I moved forward, took hold of the rod and yanked hard. At the same moment, I ignited my power sword. A body crashed into the doors, dragged forward by my hefty pull on the spy stick, and came tumbling in. I leapt in to straddle the body, but despite his surprise, he writhed away with a curse and threw a punch. I had a vague impression of a tall, thickly built man in form-fitting leather. We flopped over together, wrestling, overturning a couch and knocking down a candlestand. My opponent had a good grip on the wrist of my sword arm. So I punched him in the throat with my left hand. He collapsed, retching, onto the floor. I got him in time to hear a strong voice say, "Put the weapons down now!" A short, hunched figure stood in the open doorway. Bettencourt had both pistols trained on it, but was slowly lowering them, despite himself. The figure had used the will. I brushed the tingle aside, but it was too much for Midas. The needle pistols thumped onto the carpet. "Now, you," the figure said, turning its silhouette towards me. "Disarm that power blade." I seldom had an opportunity to feel the effect of psycho-manipulation. The technique was different from the ones I employed, and the force of will was unmistakably potent. I braced myself for the hideous strain of outright telepathic combat.
"You resist," said the figure.
A blade of mental energy stabbed into my skull, rocking me backwards. I knew at once I was fundamentally outclassed. This was an old, powerful, practiced mind. A second stab of pain, cutting into the first. The man I had left choking was now on his knees. Another psyker. More powerful than the first, it seemed, but with far less control or technique. His attack seared through my skull and made me bark out in pain. But I blocked him as I stumbled back and stung his eager mind away with a desperate, unfocused jab. The boiling psychic waves were rattling the windows and vibrating the furniture. Glasses shattered and Bettencourt fell, whimpering. The hunched figure stepped forward again and dropped me to my knees with renewed mental assaults. I felt blood spurt from my nose. My vision swam. My grip on the sword remained tight. Abruptly, it stopped. Roused by the disturbance, both Amos and Beckwin had burst into the room. Beckwin screamed. Her psychic blankness, abruptly intruding on the telepathic maelstrom, suddenly blew the energies out, like a vacuum snuffing the heart of a fire. The hunched figure cried out and stumbled in surprise. I drove forward, grabbed him, and hurled him bodily across the chamber. He seemed frail, but surprisingly heavy for such a small mass. Bettencourt recovered his weapons and lit the lamps. The man I had pulled through the doors was little more than a youth, big built, with a long, shaved skull and a slit of a mouth. He was crumpled by the windows, semi-conscious. He wore a black leather body glove adorned with equipment harnesses. Beckwin relieved him of his holstered sidearm. The other, the hunched figure, rose slowly and painfully, ancient limbs cracking and protesting. He wore long, dark robes. His thin hands were clad in black satin gloves. A number of gaudy rings protruded from the folds of the gown. He pulled back his cowl. He was very old. His weathered, lined face wizened like a fruit stone. His throat, exposed at the gown's neckline, betrayed traces of the augmetic work that undoubtedly encased his age-twisted body. His eyes blazed at me from their deep sockets with cold fury.
"You have made a mistake," he said, wheezing. "A fatal one, I have no doubt."
He produced a chunky amulet and held it up. The sigil it bore was unmistakable.
"I am Inquisitor Commodus Volk."
I smiled. "Well met, brother," I said. Commodus Volk stared at my rosette for a few lingering seconds, then looked away. I could feel the psychic throbbing of his rage.
"We have a conflict of jurisdiction," he managed to say, straightening his robes.
His assistant, now back on his feet, stood in the corner of the chamber and gazed sullenly at me. "Then let us resolve it," I offered. "Explain to me why you invade my apartments in the dead of night."
"My work brought me to Gudrun 8 months ago. An ongoing investigation, a complex matter. A rogue trader had come to my attention, one Efris Tanakbre. I had begun to close my net around him when he was scared into flight and got himself killed. Simple cross-checking revealed that a grain merchant called Farcheval had somehow been instrumental in that incident."
"Farcheval is my cover here on Gudrun."
"You see fit to play act and hide your true nature," he said scornfully.
"We each have our methods, Inquisitor," I replied. I'd never met the great Commodus Volk before, but his reputation preceded him. An intractable Puritan in his ethic, almost leading to the hard line of the mono-dominance, but for the fact of his remarkable psychic abilities. I believe something of a Thorian doctrine suited his beliefs. He had served as a novitiate with the legendary Absalom Angevin 300 years before, and since then had played a key role in some of the most thorough and relentless purges in sector history. His methods were open and direct. Stealth, cooperation, and subterfuge were distasteful concepts to him. He used the full force of his status and the fear it generated to go where he pleased and demand anything of anyone to achieve his goals. In my experience, the heavy-handed, terror-inspiring approach closes as many doors as it smashes open. Frankly, it didn't surprise me to learn he had already been on this planet for a full 8 months. He looked at me as if I was something he had almost stepped in.
"I am discomforted when I see Inquisitors holding to the soft, cunning ways of the Radical. That way heresy lies, Eisenhorn."
That made me start. I consider myself, as I have reported, very much of the puritanical outlook. Staunch, hard line in my own way, though flexible enough to get the job done efficiently. Yet here was Volk, gauging me as a radical. And at that moment, next to him, I felt I may as well be the most extreme, dangerous heresian, the most artful and scheming recongregator. I tried to push past that. "We need to share more information, Inquisitor. I'll take a guess and say your investigation somehow involves the Glor family." Volk said nothing and showed no response, but I felt his assistant tense psychically behind me. "Our work is indeed clashing," I went on. "I, too, am interested in House Glor." In short, simple terms, I laid out the matter of Eiklone's activities on Hubris and drew the connection to Glor and Gudrun by way of the mysterious Pontius. I had his interest now.
"Pontius is just a name, Eisenhorn. Pontius Glor, on the other hand, is long dead. I served with worthy Angevin in the purge that destroyed him. I saw his corpse."
"Yet here you are, investigating the Glors anyway." He exhaled slowly, as if making his mind up.
"After Pontius Glor's eradication, the House of Glor made great efforts to distance itself from his heresy. But Angevin, rest his immortal soul, always suspected that the taint ran deeper, and that the family was not free of corruption. It is an ancient house, and powerful. It is difficult to probe its secrets. But from time to time, over the past 200 years, I have turned my eye to them. 15 months ago, prosecuting a coven on Seder 7, I uncovered traces which suggested that particular coven and several other minor groups were collectively being run by an all-but-invisible parent cult, A cult of great scope and power, old and hidden, stretching across many worlds. Some traces led to Gudrun. That Gudrun is the Glor's ancestral home was, for me, too much of a coincidence.
Now we make progress, I said, sitting down in a high-backed chair and pulling on a shirt Bequin brought to me from my chamber. Amos poured 6 glasses of Amasek from a decanter on the dresser. Taking one as it was offered, Voke sat down opposite me. He sipped contemplatively. His assistant refused the glass that Amos offered and remained standing.
"Sit down, Haldane," Voke said. "We have things to learn here."
The assistant took a glass and sat in the corner. "I hunt out a cabal, controlled by a notorious facilitator," I continued. "A cabal set on performing an abominable crime. The trail leads to Gudrun and the Glaws. You do the same with another heretical cell."
3 others, in fact," he corrected.
3, then. "And you see the shape of a far greater organization. From the facts as they stand, we are both approaching the same evil from opposite sides." He licked his lips with a tiny, pallid tongue and nodded.
"Since coming to Gudrun, I have rooted out and burned 2 heretical cells. I am reasonably sure of the activities of another 9, 3 here in Dorset alone. I have allowed them to fester as I observe them. For months they have seemed bent on preparation for some event. Abruptly, a matter of weeks ago, their behavior changed. This would have been around the same time as your confrontation on Hubris."
"Eichlone's undertaking was also great, with extensive preparatory work. Yet at the 11th hour, something either went wrong or plans were suddenly changed. Though I defeated and destroyed him, his plans were really thwarted by the fact that the Pontius didn't arrive. What has your work revealed of House Glor?"
"I have visited them 2 in 3 months. On both occasions they have made every effort to answer my questions, allowing me to search the estate and their records. I have found nothing."
"I fear perhaps that is because they knew they were dealing with an inquisitor. Tomorrow, Sire Farcheval has a trade meeting with the Glors at their estate." He mused on this.
"The Inquisition has a duty to stand together, firmly, against the arch-enemies of mankind. In the spirit of cooperation, I will wait and see what your dubious methods reveal. Precious little, I imagine."
"In the spirit of cooperation, Voke, I will share all I learn with you."
"You will do better than that. The Glors know me, but not all of my students. Haldane will go with you."
"I don't think so."
"I insist. I will not have years of work ruined by another agency such as yourself running roughshod through the matter. I require my own observer on the ground, or my cooperation will not be extended."
He had me in a vice, and he knew it. To refuse outright would simply confirm my radical, careless approach in his eyes, and I had no wish to draw battle lines against another of the Inquisition, especially a man as powerful and influential as Commodus Voke. "Then he had better do exactly as I instruct him," I said. We left Dorset for the Glor Estates the next afternoon at 4. Dressed once more as wealthy but not ostentatious merchants, Bequin and I were accompanied by Amos, Betancourt, and Haldane, Voke's man. Haldane, I was pleased to see, had made a reasonable job of adopting simple civilian dress. He and Betancourt would pose as our bodyguard and escort, and Amos was to take the part of a gene biologist. Marcellis and 4 other luxuriously robed envoys from the regal bonded merchant guild of Synesius were waiting for us at the guild headquarters. An atmospheric launch had been prepared. The launch, a burnished dart bearing the guild crest, left the landing platform of the guild building's roof and rose smoothly into the overcast sky. It was, Marcellis informed us, to be a 2-hour flight. A guild envoy circulated through the richly furnished cabin with trays of refreshment. Marcellis explained our itinerary. A formal dinner with the representatives of House Glor that evening, an overnight stay, and then a tour of the estates the following morning. After that, negotiations, if both parties were still interested. We flew west, inland, leaving the inclement coastal weather behind, and passing into a sunlit landscape of rolling pasture, low hills, and maintained forests. The snaking silver line of the Drunna winked below us. There were occasional small settlements, farmsteads, a compact market town with a tall ecclesiarchy spire. Once in a while, we saw another air vehicle in the distance. A dark range of hills began to fill the western skyline. Evening was beginning to discolour the clouds. The region approaching the hills rose in bluffs and headlands, a more majestic and wild landscape, thickly wooded on escarpments and deep vales. Already, Michelli's boasted, we were flying over Glore property. The estate itself loomed out of the dimming hills some minutes later. A three-story main house, built in the neo-Gothic style, dominating a bluff and staring down across the deep valley from 100 window eyes. The lime-washed stone glowed lambently in the twilight. Adjoining the main structure were substantial wings built at different times. One led to stables and other considerable stone outbuildings along the edge of the woodland, and I presumed this to be the servants' block. The other wing edged the crown of the bluff and was dominated by a dome that shone gold in the sinking sun. The place was huge, and no doubt labyrinthine. The population of a modest town could have been accommodated within it. The launch settled onto a wide stone yard behind the house. At the edge of the yard, in what looked like converted coach houses, three other launches were stationed in hangars with well-equipped maintenance bays. We disembarked into the yard. The air was cold, and a night breeze was bringing spots of rain with it. The wind sighed in the stands of trees beyond the house. Heavy bars of cloud laced the evening sky above the towering hills. Servants in dark green liveries hurried out to us, taking up our luggage and raising wide, long-handled parasols to shield us from the drizzle. A number of uniformed guards from the Glore's house retinue flanked the yard. Haughty and confident in their long emerald storm coats and plumed silver helmets, the guards seemed like experienced veterans to my eyes. The servants escorted us and the guild envoys into an atrium with a black and white tiled floor and a bright, silvery cast to the light. Dozens of vast crystal chandeliers hung from the high, arched roof. More guards flanked the doorways. The Glore's militia was clearly sizable. "Welcome to the House of Glore," a woman's voice said. She approached us, a well-made woman of good high stock, her powdered face bearing the proud insouciance of all nobility. She wore a regal black gown, floor-length and wide in the skirt, and laced with a silver overstitching, and a great twin-cusped headdress of black mesh and pearls that tied under her chin with a wide black ribbon. Michelli's and the envoys bowed ceremoniously, and the five of us made more conservative nods. "The Lady Fabrina Glore," announced Michelli's. She approached, green-coated servants forming a human wake behind her. "Lady," I said.
"Sire Farchival, I am so pleased to meet you."
She gave us a brief tour of the main house. I have seldom seen such extravagance and riches outside of an imperial court or Tobias Maximus staterooms. Lean hunting dogs trotted with us. She pointed out a number of ancient paintings, mostly oil portraits, but some exquisite hololithic works, as well as vivid psych-picked miniatures. Her illustrious family, uncles, grandfathers, cousins, matriarchs, warlords. Here was Vernal Glore in the dress uniform of the House Militia. Here was Orkees Glore, entertaining the Royal House of Samita. Over there, Lutine and Gyves Glore, brothers at the hunt. There, great Oberon himself, in the robes of an imperial commander, one hand resting on an antique globe of Gudrun. The envoys made appropriate noises of admiration. Fabrina herself seemed to be just going through the motions. She was acting the hostess. We were, after all, just grain merchants. This was a duty, an obligation. I saw Amos making surreptitious notes. I, too, made careful observations, especially of the house geography. In one long hallway, the stone floor was dressed by the rather worn pelts of three carnadons, skinned, spread-eagled, their massive tusked mouths and baleful eyes frozen in attitudes of rage. Even in this sad state, the size and power of these creatures spoke for themselves.
"We hunted them, but there are few left now," Fabrina Glore remarked, offhand, seeing my interest. "Old times long past. Life was rather more feudal then. Today House Glore looks entirely to the future."
At dinner, in the massive banqueting hall, we were joined by Uricel Glore, the commander of the House Militia, and his eldest brother, Oberon, the current Lord Glore. But the dinner was not solely in our honour. A cousin of the Glore family and his entourage were visiting from off-world, as were several other trade delegations and a wealthy shipmaster called Gorgone Locke. I was not surprised. Visiting grain traders, even ones accompanied by the prestigious Guild Synesius, hardly merited a formal banquet. It was appropriate we should be honoured by our inclusion at a larger event. No doubt we were meant to be impressed. I attended with Bequin and Amos. There was no place for servants and bodyguards here, so Betancourt and Haldane had been escorted to our suite and food provided for them there. That suited my approach fine. There were 5 long tables in the hall, laden with roast meat, fruit, and countless delicacies. Attentive butlers and serving staff moved everywhere, offering platters and topping up glasses. Stern members of the house militia, in green and brocade dressed uniforms and polished silver helmets, stood at every corner of the chamber. We were on the 3rd table, with a contingent of livestock merchants from Gallinate, a city on Gudrun's southern continent. Our status afforded us the company of Lady Fabrina, Captain Terence, from the Household Guard, and a talkative man called Cowitz, a House Glore official responsible for buying produce. Lord Oberon and his brother Uricel presided over the head table, with their visiting cousin, the shipmaster Locke, and an elderly ecclesiarch called Datso. Cowitz was happy to tell me that Ecclesiarch Datso represented a missionary order from the subsector Edgeworld Damask, which House Glore was sponsoring. In fact, it was difficult to shut Cowitz up. As the butlers refilled his cup, he rattled on, identifying the other parties of guests. House Glore had interests on worlds throughout the subsector, and regular banquets such as this oiled the wheels and kept things moving. Eventually, I managed to hand Cowitz off to Amos, the only man I knew capable of out-talking him. The two fell to complex discussion of the subsector balance of trade. I kept a close eye on the head table. Uricel Glore, a bloated, thick-set man in bejeweled ceremonial battle dress, was giving Gorgone Locke plenty of attention. I watched Uricel closely. There was something about the man, not the least that his wide, puffy face and slick, lacquered hair made his resemblance to portraits of his infamous ancestor Pontius uncanny. He drank unstintingly and laughed a wet, loose laugh at the shipmaster's jokes. His fat, powerful fingers constantly pulled at the braided collar of his uniform jacket to ease his wide neck. Lord Oberon was a taller, leaner man with generous, cliff-like cheekbones rising above a forked goatee. The familial characteristics of the Glore line were plain in his physiognomy, but he was more regal and distinguished, and lacked the dissolute languor of his younger sibling. Lord Glore spent the night chatting happily with his off-world cousin, a bumptious young cretin with a whooping laugh and flamboyant courtly manners. But his real interest seemed to lie with the quiet ecclesiarch, Datso. I took note of the shipmaster, too. Gorgone Locke was a raw-boned giant with hooded, sunken eyes. He had long red hair, tied back and beaded, and his jutting chin was peppered with silver stubble. I wondered about his ship and his business. I would contact Maxilla and make inquiries. The banquet lasted until past midnight. As soon as was polite, we retired to our rooms. The Glores had given us a suite of rooms in the west wing. Outside, the wind had got up and was making plaintive sighs down the old chimney flues and open grates. Rain pattered against windows, and doors and shutters twitched and knocked in the draughts. Haldane was alone in the suite's sitting room when we came back. He had several data slates open for study on a table and looked up as we came in. "Well?" I asked him. He and Betancourt had run sweeps of the immediate wing whilst we had been dining. He showed me the results. Most of the rooms were spy-wired with vox thieves and a few picked sensors, and there was a complex infrastructure of alarm systems. Haldane had set up a small jammer to blind the spyware in our suite.
"Comparisons," he said,
showing me an overlay of 2 charts on a data slate.
"The green areas show the parts of the building my master gained access to during his visits."
Voke had been obliging enough to supply me with reports of his inspections.
"We can overlay in red the results of the sweeps your man and I have managed to make this evening."
There were considerable discrepancies. Voke may have opened every door he could find, but this showed me ghost areas that he had not gained access to because he hadn't known they were there. "These are cellars?" I asked.
"Underground rooms, certainly,"
said Haldane. He had a soft, sickly voice that seemed to seep from his slit-like mouth.
"Adjoining the wine vaults."
The drapes billowed in as an exterior window opened. Betancourt, his hooded black body glove wet with rain, climbed inside. He pulled off his grip gloves and boots and unstrapped his equipment harness. "What did you find?" Dripping and cold, he took a glass of spirits Beckwin brought him and showed me his scanner pad.
The roof is lousy with alarms. I didn't dare probe too far, even with my jammers and sensors. There are rooms under the east wing that Inquisitor Vogue didn't know about. A network of tunnels seems to link them to the west wing under the courtyard.
I spent a few more minutes running through the details and then went into my room to change. I put on a heat-insulated body glove of matte black plastic weave with a tight-fitting hood and supple gloves. Then I strapped a webbing harness around my torso and filled the integral pouches with a compact scope, a set of multi-keys, a folding knife, two spools of monofilament wire, a tubular torch, two jamming units, and a scanner pad. I secured my Vox unit's earpiece under my hood, buckled an auto pistol into the rig strapped across my chest, dropped two spare clips into a thigh pouch, and finally placed my inquisitorial rosette in my hip pocket. This was an endeavor that risked discovery. The rosette would be my joker, to be played if it became necessary. I went back into the sitting room and laced on the grip gloves and grip boots that Betancourt had been using. "If I'm not back in an hour, you can start to worry," I told them. Outside, blackness, rain, and the assault of the wind. The outside wall of the great house was soaked and old, the lime wash crumbling in places. I had to test every move I made to make sure the overlapping teeth of the grip pads on my hands and feet were secure. I moved along the side of the house, feeling my way, until I was able to crouch on an outcrop of guttering. I taped Betancourt's data slate to my left forearm for easy reference. The tiny backlit screen showed a three-dimensional model of the building, and an inertial locator built into the slate moved the map and kept my current location centered. Over the downpour, I heard feet crunching gravel, two stories below. I clung to the bricks and tapped off the slate so that the screen glow wouldn't give me away. Two men from the house militia, huddled in foul weather capes, passed below me, lit by the windows on the ground floor. They took shelter in a doorway porch, and shortly after that, I saw the flash of an igniter or match. Presently, the cloying odor of obscura drifted up to me. They were almost directly below my perch, and I didn't dare move until they were gone. I waited. My joints were going numb from the cold and from the hunched position I had been forced to adopt simply to stay on the gutter. The rain grew still heavier, and the wind swished the invisible trees of the steep woods behind the house. I could hear the men chatting, an occasional laugh. This wouldn't do. I was losing time and the feeling in my legs. I focused, drew in a calming breath, and reached out with the will. I found their minds, two warm traces in the cold below me. They were soft and blurred, their responses undoubtedly slowed by the opiate effects of the obscura. Difficult minds to plant strong suggestions in, but vulnerable to paranoia. I drove in with the will, toying gently with their anxieties. Within seconds, they started from the cover of the porch, hissing animatedly at each other, and headed off at a trot across the yard. Relieved, I moved down the wall, bracing my weight against a jutting window ledge as I found footholds around a downpipe bracket. On the ground, I hugged the shadows of the west wing and moved down the yard. Betancourt's careful reconnaissance had shown up laser trips around the gatehouse, and others that extended from the edges of the border beds to the basin of a fountain in the yard. Though I could not see them, they were precisely marked on the slate, and I simply stepped over each in turn, all except the last, which ran at waist height and which I ducked under. My goal was the launch hangars on the far side of the rear yard. The sweeps had shown up an access point to the cellar network there. Betancourt had located others, but they were all in private areas of the house, or in staff sections such as the scullery, the cold store, and the meat pantries. The shutter doors of the launch hangars were closed, and the lights off within. I gripped my way up the outside stone and up along the shallow tiled roof. At the summit of each hangar roof was a metal box vent designed to expel exhaust fumes. With my folding knife, I prized a louvered metal panel away and slid into the duct, feet first. The short metal funnel of the duct was open below me, and I looked down at the top of a parked launch. A short drop, and I was crouching on the back of the vehicle in the dim garage. I got off the craft and went around behind it. A small wall hatch led through into a servicing workshop, which then opened into a parts store. The ferrocrete floor was spotted with oil, and I had to move carefully in the dark to avoid knocking into obstructions such as lathes, tool trolleys and dangling hoist chains. I checked the slate. The access way was at the rear of the parts store. This store was taking itself much more seriously. A tamper-proof ceramite seal, a tumbler alarm, and a keypad for entry codes. I sighed, though I hadn't expected this to be easy. I would need to tape a jammer to the latch to avoid tripping any alarm or access signal. Then it would be a job for the scanner to search and configure a usable code. 10 minutes' work if I was lucky. Hours if not. I pulled off my grip gloves so I could more easily manipulate the tools, and paused. An idea struck me. My mentor, the mighty Hapshant, had lacked psychic skills of his own, a dyed-in-the-wool mono-dominant, Emperor love him. But he had been a firm believer in gut instinct. He told me a servant of the Emperor could do worse than trust a flash of instinct. In his opinion, the Emperor himself placed such feelings there. I tapped the word De Sumner into the pad. The lock cycled, and the door opened. A clean, warm, well-ventilated staircase, significantly newer than the main structures of the estate, took me down into the cellar system. There was a caged lamp every 3 meters down the wall. By the chart and my estimation, I was some 10 meters underground, moving beneath the east wing. I removed my hood to hear better. De Sumner opened another hatch, and I entered a long hall with hatch doors along one side. One stood open, and I could hear voices and smell smoke. I edged along and skirted the hatch so I could peer in.
"Secured with 2 weeks," a voice was saying.
"Said that month ago," another snorted. "What's the matter? You're trying to inflate your fee?"
The room was some kind of lounge or study. Books and slates were racked with archive-like precision in wooden stacks along the walls. Soft light glowed from pendant lamps, and also from a number of sealed glass-topped caskets in front of the shelving. They reminded me of the protective controlled environment units Imperial libraries used to display especially ancient and valuable texts. The room was carpeted, and as I craned round, I could see 4 men sitting around a low table in throne-like armchairs. One had his back to me, but from the folds of his coat falling over the chair's arm, I was certain it was Uricel Glor. Facing him, sitting back in his chair, was the shipmaster, Gorgon Locke. The other two I didn't know, but I had a feeling they'd both been at the dinner. They all had glasses of liquor, and one of the unknown men was using a water pipe to inhale obscura. Various objects lay on the table between them, some wrapped in velvet, others unwrapped and displayed. They looked like stone tablets, old relics of some sort.
"I'm just trying to explain the delay, Glor," Locke said. "They're a difficult enough culture to deal with at the best of times."
"That's why we pay you," Glor said with a scoffing laugh.
He leaned forward and toyed with one of the tablets.
"But we won't stand much further delay. We've invested a great deal in this matter. Time, funds, resources. It's meant holding back or cancelling other enterprises, some of them very special to us."
"You will not be disappointed, Lord," said the man with the narco pipe.
He was dressed simply in black, a slightly built, bald individual with watery blue eyes.
"The archaeozenan provenance of these items speaks for itself. The Saruthi are serious about their offer."
Uricel started to reply and got to his feet. I ducked into cover and then moved away down the hall. Iclone's code opened the door at the end, and I crept through into a wide, circular vault. 2 more hatches of regular pattern led off to either side. Ahead of me was a larger archway protected by a force screen instead of a door. I backed into hiding alongside this opening as someone cancelled the force screen from inside. A figure stepped out, turning to raise the screen again. It was Cowitz. I took him from behind, an arm locked around his throat to silence him, another hand pinning his right arm. He gurgled and struggled. I twisted him round and slammed his head against the doorframe. Cowitz went limp. I dragged him in through the open force portal. A control on the inner wall raised the screen again. The chamber was long with a low ceiling. The climate-controlled air was dry. I realized it was a chapel of sorts. A stone-floored, rectangular nave leading to a shape that seemed to me an altar. The room was otherwise bare of features, even seats or pews. Light glowed from recessed lamps in the roof. Leaving Cowitz on the floor, I strode down the length of the chapel and took a closer look at the altar. It was 2 meters high, black, fashioned from a single piece of obsidian. The glassy stone seemed to glow with an internal light, On top of it was a jeweled prayer box about 30 centimeters square. I lifted the lid carefully with the blade of my knife tool. In a bed of velvet lay an intricate sphere. It looked like a jagged lump of quartz, the size of a clenched fist, inlaid with gold circuits and complex woven wires, like an oversized uncut gemstone in a bizarre, ornate setting. I spun around at a sound from behind me. Cowitz, blood dripping from his dented forehead, stood pointing a las pistol at me. His face was pale, angry, confused. "Step away from the Pontius, scum," he said.